Back in February of this year, the Women's Foundation of Minnesota and the Center for Women and Public Policy at the Humphrey Institute of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota released a report titled Status of Women and Girls in Minnesota. Deborah Fitzpatrick, who is the director of the Center on Women and Public Policy, collected the data, produced the research, and wrote the research overview. She joins us now from down in Minneapolis. Deborah, thank you so much for joining us on the Roadhouse on this Friday evening.
Thank you so much for having me, Bob.
On the March 12th issue of Newsweek magazine, featured, I'm sure, because of Women's History Month, featured women predominantly, in fact, almost exclusively in the magazine. And if one looked at it at first blush, one would guess that throughout the world, and most particularly in the United States, women on the whole are doing pretty well in relationship to their roles and their status versus those of men. Your report might indicate something different, doesn't it? At least here in the state of Minnesota.
Well, yes, I think it does. I mean, first of all, I do want to acknowledge that we've made enormous progress in the last century, and we've broken, shattered many ceilings or cracked many ceilings, as Hillary Clinton did. But the data suggests that kind of over the past decade, progress has really sort of flatlined and stalled out, kind of well short of where we think we need to be. And where we think we need to be is kind of in a state where women as well as men are treated fairly and have equal opportunities, experience the world as a safe place, and have their hard work and contributions valued in similar ways.
It is... After the election of the President Obama back in 2008, we heard a lot of talk about living in a post-racial world. I've also heard a similar comment about gender. We live in a post-gender world. Number one, what does that mean? And two, why isn't that true?
Well, you know, I think when people talk about a post-gender world, they're sort of envisioning a place where, you know, it really doesn't matter whether you're a man or a woman, that you sort of, again, experience the world in the same way and are, you know, treated the same way, have equal opportunities, and so on, as I mentioned about my sort of idealistic vision of where I think our state needs to be on this. Why I think, you know, there's a lot of data in our research, and I'll just kind of maybe run through a couple of major trends that I think suggest that we're not quite there yet. And I think, you know, it's important to acknowledge that women are growing an indispensable part of our economy. You know, 80% of mothers now work in the state, and half of these mothers are now the primary breadwinner in their family. But yet they continue, women again, continue to earn less compared to their male counterparts. And this is true even for younger women fresh out of college, and especially for women with advanced degrees. And you know, women continue to be clustered, nearly half of the state's women are clustered in low-wage jobs, where their efforts tend to be undervalued when you look at the skills, training, and risks associated with the work they do, you know, not to mention the importance of the work that they do to the functioning of our society. And, you know, at all levels of leadership, even though we have these sort of, you know, standout examples that get a lot of play in things like Newsweek, when we really look at the data at all levels of leadership, from school boards to corporate boards, women remain conspicuously underrepresented. Women continue to do the majority of caregiving in our homes. The time use surveys continue to show that, you know, despite sort of perceptions that men are doing more, and they are. But still, women continue to do the majority of that kind of caregiving, and that really contributes to constrained job choices, and increasingly studies showing that both at unconscious and overt levels, it leads to sort of detrimental stereotyping about women's abilities. And finally, I would say that we're actually sort of slipping backwards when it comes to the sort of sexualization of women and girls, and, you know, variety of studies showing that even... You know, our cartoon characters are becoming more sexualized. You know, the women or girls portrayed in our cartoons are you know, showing more cleavage, wearing mm-hmm. less clothes, all of those kinds of things. And so I think those are just a few of the kind of big trends that would suggest that we're really not quite there in a post-gender world.
Your report, which I've had the opportunity to read, it's extensive. It also is eye-opening, to say the least. covered four major areas, and you kind of touched on some of those: economics, safety, health, and leadership. And again, I was struck by how in all of those fields, quite frankly, women in Minnesota were not doing as well as, you know, I think I thought they were, or maybe a lot of people thought they were, given at least what you hear or don't hear in the media. My question is, do you have any data that's, and I want to talk a little bit, although we're, unfortunately, because of time, we're not going to, you know, be able to get as in-depth as I'd like to, but, and we will touch on some of those different areas, but do you have any data that would say how well women in Minnesota are doing in comparison to other places in the country?
Yeah, well, we have looked at a variety of the these data points compared them to national studies. Some of the data sources that we use, like the census data, is the data that we can compare ourselves to others. And I think that, generally speaking, across the board, we're not doing any better than other places in the country. There are some notable examples. For example, women of color in the state of Minnesota actually are doing worse when it comes to poverty. We have a higher poverty rate for women of color in our state than other states in the country. We also have some sort of economic dynamics that make it particularly hard for, again, women working at, you know, earning less and working in low-wage fields to survive, and that is we have the third highest daycare costs relative to relative to our income in the country, which that's been consistent for the last 3 years. We're not making any headway on that one. We also have very expensive housing in the state, and so our rental housing is ranked the least affordable in the Midwest. And so when you sort of couple those kinds of sort of economic issues with the ability of women to earn at the same levels of men, it creates a particularly difficult dynamic. But on things like sexual violence, domestic violence, a lot of these other issues, our wage gap, other things like that, we're pretty much average.
Okay. We're visiting with Deborah Fitzpatrick, who is the director of the Center on Women and Public Policy at the Humphrey Institute of Public Affairs, about the recent report, Status of Women and Girls in Minnesota. I was struck, and you mentioned it, but I was struck, for instance, by the gap, the economic gap in terms of median earnings with full-time employees, the fact that white women earn only about 80% of what white men do, but even more struck, as you mentioned, about the gap between what women of color, for instance, African-American women only earn 62 cents to a dollar, Native American women, I believe it's 66, down to Latina women who earn 56 cents for every dollar a white man earns. Can you give any reason why that large a disparity for women of color?
Well, I think women of color are dealing with discrimination on two levels, right? They're dealing with gender-based discrimination as well as race-based discrimination. And so we know that, you know, when you compare women of color to men of color, you know, similar kinds of disparities are there. So, you know, it's both issues around race, ethnicity, and gender that are sort of coming together in this sort of perfect storm among those women.
Clearly, in terms of economics, you also mentioned leadership and surprisingly, I guess I would say surprisingly, small number of women who are represented on corporate boards, actually a shrinking number. As time goes on, the few women who are elected to representative office, more startling, it seems to me, the few number of women that even run for political office. This in spite of, you know, if you go way back, things like the Equal Rights Amendment, affirmative action, all sorts of things. Why have this society, and let's deal with Minnesota where this report was, why have we been so slow to treat women as equals?
Well, I think there's a number of things that contribute to underrepresentation of women in leadership, and I'll just kind of hit on a couple of them quickly. One of them is that there's a huge body of research that's developed that shows that women's qualifications are undervalued. And I think that's something not only do people, men and women, other men and women do that to women, but women do that to themselves. So, you know, there's a lot of research, for example, that shows if you put a male name on a resume and a female name on the same resume, the female one will be rated lower. And so this is just kind of some long-standing sort of stereotypes about how we think of men and women and their relationship to leadership. And so there's these sort of stereotypes that continue to prevail, and these are stereotypes that are held by both men and women, and they affect the way women and men treat other women, but also the way they perceive themselves. And so, you know, when we try to, and my center does a lot of work to try to, you know, convince more women to run for office, is one of the things we do to help women see themselves as leaders and then give them the tools they need to take advantage of leadership opportunities. We see that most times women will say, I'm not qualified to do that. Whereas men tend to, you know, just to sort of automatically see themselves as leaders and much more frequently. So that's one of the things that contributes to that. I think that that plays out in a lot of other ways in our workplaces as we promote people and we choose who to hire and who to put into leadership roles within our workplaces, and that all kind of builds together. I think there are a variety of factors that contribute to that, but that's one of the key ones.
Mm-hmm. I was also struck, alarmed, I think is a better word, by the statistics that were in the report regarding the safety of women, and the numbers of women who have reported sexual and physical violence, both at very early ages and all throughout their life. Just as an example, at midlife, 33% of Minnesota women have reported sexual violence, 32%, so basically one woman in three by midlife has had some experience with physical or sexual violence. Interestingly, and maybe not so much, almost the same percentage reported physical violence from intimate partner. Would that indicate that that's where most of the violence comes from? Or am I reading those statistics incorrectly?
Yeah, I think in a lot of cases they're connected. A lot of cases, women who are experiencing domestic violence are also experiencing sexual violence, and we know the vast majority of sexual violence is perpetrated by someone a woman knows, mm-hmm. you know, despite the sort of idea that we have that there are these sort of, you know, rapists that we don't know out there lurking in alleys. Most of sexual violence actually occurs from an intimate partner, somebody that the person knows. So in some cases they're linked, but they're not all exclusive, you know, it's not completely. Some women are just experiencing sexual violence, and some women are just experiencing domestic violence. But I think the thing that both of those numbers sort of point to is that we've sort of normalized this violence in our society. You know, if many other things we can think of that were, you know, and the negative consequences of this kind of violence are significant, and that's also in the report. But you know, if something else is affecting that many people, you'd think we'd just be outraged as a society.
Exactly.
We've kind of normalized it and sort of think of it as background noise in our lives, that's just the way it is and the way it's going to be. And I think that's the part that's really concerning, and that starts back in our high schools and you know, just moves right on up the trajectory. So that's the other thing we see, is there's just this sort of, you know, upward trajectory towards violence, and, you know, like 12% of our high school senior women reporting that they've, you know, experienced sexual violence, 23% of our college women, and then, as you mentioned, by midlife, 33%. So, you know, just the prevalence of this in our society and the fact that it's been fairly consistent for the last decade, we're really not budging on these numbers, you know, I think is you know, really quite concerning.
Not only that, but this one also, again, was alarming that over 40%, almost 44% of 12th graders, who admitted to physically or sexually hurting someone they were dating.
Those are the
boys.
And we see that this is sort of multi-generational as well. So, you know, students who have been sexually abused, young people who have been sexually abused are more likely to sexually abuse. And so, again, I think that we see this sort of multi-generational phenomenon occurring where we're not sort of disrupting this pattern, and then it just perpetuates itself.
I want to deal with a little bit, and I want to remind our listeners once again, we're visiting with Deborah Fitzpatrick, who directs the Center on Women and Public Policy at the Humphrey Institute. Let's talk about leadership a little bit, and then I want to backtrack a little bit, because all of this seems like incredibly bad news, and I want to talk a little bit about whether there's any light at the end of the tunnel. But this was really interesting to me. It's, you know, public perception, I would bet, would say there are more women than ever, and perhaps more women than men, involved in elective office, school boards, city councils, whatever. And yet, that's not true. It's far from true. And this was very interesting to me. Only 22% of mayoral, 26% of city council, and 17% of county commission candidates in 2010 were women. You mentioned because of perhaps public perceptions, not the least of which is on the part of women, that, oh, I'm not qualified to do that. Is that, do you think that's the main reason that's holding women back from even becoming candidates, or are they being held back by somebody else?
Well, I think that there's a perception that, first of all, I would say that, again, going back to my earlier point about women continuing to do the majority of caregiving in their families, that's a significant issue, and, you know, we can't underplay that what we're, many women perceive running for office as taking on a third job, and, you know, I think we're in a sort of situation now where we have this sort of superwoman phenomenon where women are kind of trying to do it all. Mm-hmm. You know, they're working, you know, again, they're becoming an increasingly important part of the economic engine of their families. And at the same time, they're, you know, sort of holding together the homestead. And then to think about adding an elective office on top of that, you know, is just almost too hard for most people to think of.
Sure.
I think also that we know from the research that women need to be asked to run, and this sort of relates to the qualifications question. But they, they need to be encouraged more, and part of that goes back to the qualifications issue that I mentioned earlier. But we know from the research and getting to some silver linings, right, that when women are asked, that they're more likely to run. And so there's some very simple sort of things that we as a society can do, and as individuals, that we can do more of to sort of try to turn this around. And I think there is some complacency because there is this perception that this is not something we need to worry about anymore, as you mentioned at the outset of your question.
Post-gender.
Yeah, that we're post-gender, that women are everywhere they need to be, and you know, that we're not having issues here. And, you know, I think for me, one of the, you know, standouts also is that there are 50% of our county commissions in the state that control $5 billion of resources, many of which go to human resources, you know, to human human services.
Uh-huh.
50% of those county commissions have no women on them. And so, you know, we really like to think that there's really no place like that anymore, right, where there's really no women at the table. And I think it's particularly egregious when you think about the growing research that suggests that teams of diverse people make better decisions.
Sure.
And so, you know, we've seen that in the corporate world, where we've seen the companies that have more women on their boards have a better bottom line, you know, and we see that in a variety of other research looking at teams in a variety of situations. And so, you know, it's really a shame because it's not only hurts those women, but I think it's hurting the community.
Back in the 1970s, and I'm probably getting the time frame pretty close to correct, when there was a lot of publicity about the fact that there were not equal rights, not equity for women, women hit the streets in droves with protests, and it was in front of our face all the time. Granted, as you said at the outset, women have made a lot of progress, but clearly by the numbers that are in this report, not nearly enough. Why aren't, same with civil rights, why aren't more people out there with signs in their hand?
Well, I do think there's some complacency, and I do think there's some sense that this is not something that we need to be worried about, although I would say that I think there are, you know, some signs around some current issues that, you know, have raised people's awareness about the fact that they can't necessarily take for granted even the progress that's been gained. So when we look at the, you know, issues around access to contraceptives and kind of the conversation that's been occurring in our country based on that, and, you know, for me, that's not just a women's issue. That's really an issue for families, even though it's sort of been, you know, sort of placed in the laps of women in terms of the debate. I think that's a significant issue for families. But again, women are the ones who ultimately are sort of held accountable for, you know, the reproductive situation in our country.
Yeah.
And so, you know, those kinds of things are really starting to, you know, there's an incredible firestorm that occurred when Rush Limbaugh made the comments that he made. And so I think, you know, in that kind of context, we are seeing people sort of wake up a little bit. And that's part of why we do this project, frankly, and try to get this research. So I really appreciate you, you know, featuring this on your show, because, you know, we do want to, you know, just remind people that this sort of idea that there aren't still important issues that we need to work on, just try to challenge that as much as we can and get the, you know, data into people's hands so they can see what we're talking about.
Following up on that, Deborah, if people are interested, and hopefully they are after this, at least those who have listened, where can they go to see the report? Is there a website that they could go to and access this report?
Yeah, absolutely. So the report is available and it's downloadable at wfmn.org, WFMN, like Minnesota.org. It's on the front page of that website. You can download it there. And I would just really encourage people to take a look because, as you mentioned, it's been a little bit gloomy in all, you know, all of the things that we've been talking about today. But we really do believe, while policy is important, and I come from a public policy school, so, you know, policies that affect women are important, we really believe that everyone can contribute to changing this. And in the report, in addition to the statistics, we have some columns of opportunities and ways that individual people can sort of contribute to advancing equity in 30 minutes or less. So there's a lot of things we can do in our individual lives to change this. And so I would encourage people to check out those opportunities as well.
I want to thank you for that. Unfortunately, we are running out of time, and I didn't have a chance to ask you, okay, what can people do? But you do have that in each one of the sections, things that people can do as individuals to make a difference, and I think that's important. We've been visiting with Deborah Fitzpatrick. She is the director of the Center on Women and Public Policy at the Humphrey Institute of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota regarding the report just issued in February, Status of Women and Girls in Minnesota. Deborah, I want to thank you very much for taking time this evening to be with us.
Thank you so much, Bob. I really appreciate it.
Take care.